Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Southeastern Wyoming has been expecting an oil boom for years that's never arrived. Just across the border in Colorado, drilling has reached breakneck pace, but Wyoming has been relatively quiet until now. The discovery of a new, more promising oil reserve has led to a surge of interest in oil and gas development in Laramie County over the last few months. And as Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, that's catching the attention of both market analysts and area landowners.
In May of 2013, oil and gas companies applied for 9 permits to drill in Laramie County. In May of 2014,
Laramie County had 132 drilling permits.
That's oil and gas supervisor Mark Watson. The sudden flurry of activity can be attributed to a deep sandstone formation called the Codell. Watson says he wouldn't call the increased interest a boom until the wells actually get drilled, but he says there's the potential.
You know, the companies that are down there are, they're serious about eventually drilling these wells. They just need to learn more about the formation.
Bloomberg News recently reported that even companies that are traditionally conservative in their estimates of an area's potential, like EOG Resources, are starting to rank the Rocky Mountain region alongside the much better-known Bakken in North Dakota and Eagleford in Texas. In Laramie County, the promising reserves happen to coincide with the city of Cheyenne. Watson says that means more drilling and more fracking in populated areas.
That's getting to be a big issue. You know, Colorado's already dealing with it, and now that this is probably going to be an issue in Laramie County because, you know, they're going to be drilling close to people's houses.
Houses like Deb Showerman's. She bought property near Cheyenne last May.
Moved up there with my 2 horses, built a barn, put in fences.
A few weeks ago, workers started staking out the adjacent property. She found out EOG has plans to put in as many as 32 horizontal wells. The closest well pad would be several hundred feet behind her house. Sharman says it never occurred to her when she bought the property that drilling could someday happen in her backyard, and she's worried.
The health impact, all the flaring and all the chemicals that are going to go in.
Hoping to get reassurances about some of those concerns, Showerman was one of 24 landowners who attended a meeting in Cheyenne recently about preparing for oil and gas development. She says the concerns linger, but that she's feeling better equipped to deal with them.
Being vigilant, taking pictures, calling people. I mean, I didn't know that you should probably do all that stuff. So this has been very, very helpful because I was feeling pretty helpless.
Charman doesn't own the mineral rights beneath her property, so she won't profit at all from the new development. Jan Beacon, on the other hand, does own the minerals on her property in northeast Cheyenne. But she shares Charman's concerns about the health impacts. When we spoke, she was negotiating a lease with the oil and gas company that she hopes will address some of those concerns. But Beacon says the responsibility shouldn't only be on the landowner. She says there need to be stronger state regulations and enforcement of them.
You know, I understand the need for drilling and oil and gas in Wyoming. It supports the economic basis for the state. There just needs to be controls in to protect the workers, to protect the people, and to do it right.
After numerous complaints from landowners and others, the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has agreed to review its rule governing the setback of wells from houses. Right now, it's 350 feet. The commission might also take up flaring and other air quality issues later this year. But Jill Morrison with the Powder River Basin Resource Council says that process isn't moving quickly enough given the pace of development.
Really, we need a moratorium on issuing any more permits until we can get some requirements on increasing the setback so it isn't affecting people's health, safety, and welfare.
It's not immediately clear who would have the authority to do that. Watson, the oil and gas supervisor, says he doesn't.
You know, people think that we can just stop them. And if a company comes in with a drilling permit and they meet all the requirements of our current rules, I have to, by statute, approve that drilling permit. I can't just say no.
But Watson says he is negotiating with companies. For example, he says just recently he asked a company in Laramie County to move their wells further back from a house and put up better noise barriers. It may have been a first. Historically, oil and gas supervisors haven't exercised their negotiating authority. But it's not likely to be the last. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
The transport of crude oil by rail has spiked dramatically in recent years. From 2012 to 2013, the amount carried by the country's major freight railroads increased nearly 75%. That's at least according to the American Association of Railroads. Amid growing public concern about safety, new federal regulations went into effect this weekend to make sure local emergency authorities are notified when some trains come through. Grace Hood of KUNC reports for Inside Energy.
I'm standing on a dirt road in a very remote part of Weld County. To my right are agricultural fields, and in front of me, about 75 yards, are Union Pacific train tracks. It's the site of an oil spill where six cars carrying crude oil fell off the tracks, releasing about 5,000 gallons of oil. This spill happened about 1 month ago. As Colorado's oil production boom continues, exceeding the capacity of pipelines that traditionally have carried the oil, more companies are shipping crude by rail. Over the past 2 years, companies have built two crude loading facilities and doubled capacity at a third site in Colorado's Niobrara Formation along the Eastern Plains. That's caught the attention of the county's Office of Emergency Management. Roy Rudisill is office director.
We really want to be able to say, okay, we know individually, at least from our county standpoint, of what's being transported through, whether it be crude oil, whether it be other chemicals like chlorines, anhydrous ammonia, those types of things.
But he doesn't really know on a day-to-day basis. The railroads don't share that data. When his team encountered the oil spill 1 month ago, he was surprised his agency wasn't near the top of the railroad's notification list.
Having those conversations and having this incident has actually helped in the communication of, if there is another incident, we know how to get the proper communication, the right information during an incident.
The Greeley spill is one of roughly a dozen crude tanker derailments over the past year in the U.S. and Canada. Federal regulators are especially concerned about shipments of crude oil from the Bakken Formation in North Dakota, Montana, and parts of Canada. That wasn't the oil involved in the Greeley spill, but Bakken crude is believed by some to be more volatile and connected to fiery tank car accidents, one of which killed 47 people in Quebec in 2013.
Up until this time, we've had a real problem in that local emergency responders have had almost no idea of the contents of the trains that were rolling through their communities.
Lloyd Burton is a University of Colorado professor who studies rail transport of hazardous materials. He says the new Department of Transportation rule is a good start. That rule, it went into effect just last Saturday, requires railroads to share route details of large Bakken crude oil shipments.
I think that would be something that, in my view, the railroads just owe to the communities.
But that information may be something many communities will never get. A number of states have signed agreements with the railroads to not make the information public. The railroads say it's a security and competition issue. Wyoming has signed a non-disclosure agreement with Union Pacific Railroad. North Dakota and Colorado have not signed. Dave Hart is Colorado's director of emergency management. Even though the state hasn't signed an agreement, Hart says shipment details will only be released to emergency responders, specific state and local government officials.
We have to balance everything with the guidance we receive from the Department of Transportation. And it's important for us to follow the federal guidance that's been provided by the Department of Transportation.
Meantime, in Colorado, not much is known or revealed about the transport of non-Bakken crude. Union Pacific Railroad declined to share shipment details. BNSF Railway, the nation's largest oil by rail shipper, said on average it operates 3 crude oil trains per day through the state, but they will not say where or when. Back in Weld County, Director of Emergency Management Roy Rudisill says he'll continue to use historical crude oil shipment information to plan for different scenarios. He'll be watching for Bakken oil shipments, although he's not expecting much. What keeps him up at night are the things he says he hasn't planned for.
You hope you plan for everything, but there's always somewhere along the line, there's always something that's going to come up.
The cause of the Greeley accident is still under investigation. The team is expected to wrap up its work by the end of July. For Inside Energy, I'm Grace Hood.
When we come back, we'll discuss the pros of flooding and speak with U.S. Representative Cynthia Lummis. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. If you think having political candidates stopping by your home can get annoying, Wyoming U.S. Representative Cynthia Lummis feels your pain. Following the primary election loss of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, Lummis is being bombarded by those interested in that job and other leadership posts that may come free after Cantor's replacement is chosen. Lummis says the internal campaigning is something to watch.
There are so many teams out there supporting different candidates. There have been so many behind closed doors meetings to make sure that the different philosophies within our conference are represented by a candidate who's running. There are so many press inquiries, you know, who are you going to support? There have been meetings with the people who are running to find out, you know, what their agenda would be as majority floor leader, which is a very different position from either whip or speaker. So it is just fascinating. And the phones have been very active. The interesting dinner conversations this week has been like no other.
Well, I wonder if you're looking at anything.
You know, I have visited with people who share my fiscally conservative views and the fact that we believe that the fiscal conservatism has been underrepresented in the leadership and trying to make sure that a strong fiscal conservative is among those candidates who are put forward. I'm the jury is still out on some of this, so we shall see.
But I'm also wondering if you're kind of looking at the big picture, and do you worry at all that this keeps people from passing things?
Well, I do think it will have a profound effect on the immigration discussion. It is my view that any discussion of immigration legislation is dead in the water for the remainder of this year. I'm hoping that we will turn our attention in the House to passing a Republican alternative to Obamacare. We have good legislation. It is a little bit my concern that House leadership have been playing not to lose in this election cycle instead of playing to win. I think that we need to be forthright with the American people about our better ideas. We have better ideas. We have better alternatives. When I'm out around Wyoming, people say, pass a health care law. Give us an alternative. Don't just be opposed to Obamacare. And I strongly agree with that. So I'm hoping that we can further advance that notion here before Eric Cantor steps down at the end of July.
But I just wonder, I mean, my first read on that is, oh, boy, nobody wants to compromise. Nobody wants to go on the record with anything. I mean, is that going too far?
You know, Bob, I think it is going too far. I think that if you're talking specifically about immigration, I just think because of what happened to Eric Cantor, that issue is just going to go away for this year.
But you think other things can go forward?
I do. We're working every one of the appropriations bills. We have worked almost half of them now in the House, and that still gives us 6 more weeks to work the other 6 bills on the floor of the House. So I think there's a decent chance that we'll work all of the appropriations bills this year in this Congress. That's a big deal. We passed this bill that dealt with water projects so we can deepen some of our ports, deal with some of the problems in the Great Lakes and other water issues. That passed with strong bipartisan support. In fact, it passed so overwhelmingly and was signed by the president that nobody even knows about it. And that is a huge bill to get through this sort of acrimonious relationship that we're in right now. So things really are happening, but as is usually the case, When something good happens, nobody knows because it's not controversial.
Damn media. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Representative Lummis. It's always a pleasure.
My pleasure as well, Bob. Thank you.
This spring, rivers were overflowing banks all over the state. Some rivers saw record or near-record flood stages. The Laramie River hit its second highest flood level on record, and that's only 4 years after its highest on record in 2010. But floods aren't all sandbagging and property damage. They also mean plenty of water for the long, dry summer ahead. Governor Matt Mead is developing a new water strategy in hopes of keeping all this water from leaving the state too fast. But a new report by the National Climate Assessment says earlier, heavier runoffs will make capturing all that surplus much trickier.
Chip Rollins is giving a tour of the floods in his neighborhood outside Woods Landing on the Little Laramie River.
Another 6 inches, it would have been over the road right here. And it was over the road on the other side of the bridge, you'll see. For a while there, the people had a John boat parked over there. And they were holding the boat back and forth to get to their cars.
Rollins is a geographer. He just finished a study of ancient flood history on the North Platte. He's also an avid rafter and considers himself a river detective of sorts.
The thing that has been pretty well documented is that the runoff is coming earlier. You're getting the flood peaks are getting earlier and earlier in the Rocky Mountains and Great Basin.
A report by the National Climate Assessment says to expect more spring flooding, but also much drier summers, meaning the need for storing water could soon become a critical issue. Mark Schaefer is the author of the National Climate Assessment for the Great Plains. He says the state will need more reservoirs to deal with the earlier than usual runoff.
If you don't have the capacity to store that, if reservoirs already get filled, a lot more may have to run downstream, and then it's not there when it would normally come a little bit later in the year,
leaving ranchers and farmers with less water to irrigate their fields. Coleman Smith is the area manager for the Bureau of Reclamation. He says this year several of the state's dams had to release water to control the flow of the rivers. He says the state relies heavily on dams and reservoirs to manage flood damage in years like this one.
Back in the early part of this country's development, and certainly out in the West, ranchers and farmers saw all this water rushing down the river during the spring and summer, and realized that if they could build some dams and reservoirs, that they could grab that water and hold on to it for the times when they really needed it.
That's the situation Wyoming finds itself in this year. The last 2 years of low water have depleted many of the state's water stores.
Seminole is at 70% full, and Pathfinder is at 49% full. And so between those two big reservoirs, we still have a lot of capacity. And actually, we do plan on being able to handle the water on the North Platte that's coming down.
Governor Matt Mead is developing a new water strategy to deal with storage and other water issues. His office has collected lots of public input to find out what Wyomingites want most when it comes to water. Policy advisor Nephi Cole says keeping water from washing away is central on people's minds.
There's a lot of interest in water development, protection of water rights, and water storage, beneficially using the water that we have access to and protecting those water rights, was by far the largest single area of comment.
A majority of people's comments focused on water development projects like dams and reservoirs, large and small. Cole says some of the best water storage sites may be on the Wind River Indian Reservation, and talks are in the works between the governor and the tribes. But other sites have been proposed on the upper Green River at Warren Bridge and at Green River Lakes. But such projects will present major regulatory hurdles. River detective Chip Rollins doesn't like the idea of more dams.
You know, the whole dam thing, I don't know, we probably did carry that about as far as we can.
The next step for the state's water strategy plan is to narrow down the number of ideas to the best 5 or 10. The governor's office will continue to take public input on water use in the state through August 4th. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
When we come back, we'll have a pair of stories concerning issues veterans face in the state. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Returning from military service back into so-called normal society continues to be a challenge for many veterans. It doesn't help if they have difficulty getting Veterans Administration services. In Wyoming, the two VA hospitals have been criticized for the amount of time veterans need to wait to get care. Social service providers say they are trying to provide adequate services to a growing population of vets. David Allhusen is a senior social worker at the Casper VA Clinic, one of the satellite clinics set up to address the growing number of veterans who are returning to civilian life. He says veterans often face similar problems.
It's difficult for me to work, to go to school, to be with my family, and I need to know what's going on.
In Sheridan, another VA social worker, Deb Stevens, says PTSD and other trauma-related issues aren't the only problems.
Some people find themselves lost once they no longer have that mission that drives. And once you're kind of cut loose from that, sometimes it's a little hard to kind of find your grounding there.
David Poley knows this all too well. Poley is a veteran who's being treated in Casper for post-traumatic stress syndrome and other mental health issues 2 years after ending his military service. He says when he came back, he had 4 jobs in the first 9 months, and he found it difficult to succeed in the workplace. Poley says it was equally difficult to integrate into society.
Feels like you've been thrown into something, and you don't have the instructions on how to get it done.
After years in the military, he remains on edge.
Always on watch, the idea that danger is lurking around the corner.
Another veteran, Amanda Huckabee, is still dealing with the trauma she faced as a member of the military reserve. She was sexually assaulted twice, and if that was not traumatic enough, the way the military handles such cases added to it.
In the civilian world, we have rape shield laws that protect victims, and that does not exist in the military justice system. It was more of an interrogation of me as a victim. And it was not a pleasant process, to say the least.
The incident led to severe PTSD. Huckabee has gotten care, but she's concerned that some important services are not available in Wyoming. She has to travel, for instance, to Colorado Springs to be part of a Wounded Warrior support group. Huckabee wants such support groups available in Wyoming. Travel, in fact, is a big issue in the state, and veterans say it limits access to care. But social worker David Allhusen says they are starting to address those concerns with telemedicine.
Yesterday, as an example, I saw veterans in Gillette, Warland, Evanston, and even Powell just in the course of one day.
Allhusen says they can provide assessments and emergency care this way. Wyoming U.S. Representative Cynthia Lummis says even with technology, she's very concerned about whether the VA is adequately providing services for all Wyoming veterans. She continues to be concerned about wait times for VA care and says her office has taken matters into their own hands.
When we receive a call from a veteran who's been on a waiting list or whose health is deteriorating, we're trying to stay in touch with them and to get them services because they don't need sympathy, they need services.
Lema says the VA has to do more, even if it means looking outside the administration for help. For example, by providing vouchers for private practitioners across the state so vets can get the care they need. Lema says as the Veterans Administration undergoes more scrutiny in coming weeks, she hopes the organization takes a close look at how things can be improved in Wyoming so vets can get the care they need. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. For many returning military veterans, college is on the front line in transition back into civilian life. For some, settling into higher education can be a challenge. As Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank reports, Wyoming schools are working together to better support these men and women on their campuses.
Robert Sheets spent 5 years in the U.S. Navy, working on a flight deck fixing fighter jets. When he got out, the Colorado native came to Wyoming to put his GI benefit towards an anthropology degree.
Well, I was a 23-year-old freshman coming to the University of Wyoming, coming from an area where I had a huge structure system around me from being in the military, and so I had to kind of learn to build that system for myself and figure out how to be a college student after not being in school for 5 years.
Sheets says when he started here 4 years ago, there really wasn't much of a program for veterans.
It was more under the idea that veterans would kind of figure it out themselves.
There can be a lot to figure out, from navigating VA bureaucracy to dealing with problems like post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury. Marty Martinez is UW's Veterans Services Coordinator. He says making a campus veteran-friendly is easier said than done.
That's when suddenly we run into financial issues. That's when we run into personnel issues, when we run into programming issues and policy issues.
To get all colleges in the state on the same page, Martinez and UW hosted a first-of-its-kind conference this month, inviting veterans advocates from around the state to team up.
Where we can come together, share those ideas, our best practices, talk about the needs that still exist for us as institutions in supporting our veterans, and then maybe help find some solutions for those needs.
On some campuses, those needs are significant. Lisa Goss is the veterans coordinator at Casper College. She says a larger staff is needed to keep up with the growing veteran population.
I'm the only one currently providing services to veterans, and spring semester I had over 170 that I provided services to myself.
Brett Burtis, Veterans Program Director with the Northern Wyoming Community College District, said he's had to learn to do more with less. He converted an old photography darkroom in Sheridan College into a veterans service center, a common space he says is essential.
Because that's one spot that they know where they can go for a centralized point of contact for all the services that they need, the questions that they need answers. It's a spot where they can bond with other veterans.
In the past few years, UW has upped efforts to assist and encourage veterans on campus. It now offers training sessions for faculty working with vets and has a veterans services center of its own. It's a place UW senior and Navy veteran Tyler Long says has helped him a lot.
The camaraderie inside the Veterans Service Center is phenomenal. And if someone doesn't have an answer, they will find you someone that has an answer. And they also brought in tutors.
It can be difficult to tell what's really helping vets and what isn't, because most colleges don't collect any basic data on veterans to track progress, as they do with other groups. Noticing that, UW recently started identifying veterans upon application and now has a better idea of its veteran population.
And that's really what we're trying to do here is to, through data, is trying to build an accurate picture of what's happening with our veteran students in Wyoming. I think what we'll find is you're kind of shocked when you realize that, man, maybe we're not doing as well as I had thought we were.
Martinez says he works to address some important little things for his students, like when he exempted veterans from UW's on-campus housing requirement for freshman students.
Because I had a lot of people calling me saying, dude, I don't want to live on campus. And it's like, yeah, I get it. And so we worked that out very quickly.
And when veterans at Sheridan College argued that a personal wellness class was material they'd already covered in the military, Brett Burtis worked with the school to remove.
And it's just one small little change that we made, but it has a huge impact on them because now they feel like the college is listening and the college cares about me.
With small changes like these and collaborations like this conference, Wyoming colleges hope to help vets focus on education and ease their transition back into civilian life. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
These reports are part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen. It's a public media initiative to address the dropout crisis, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We're joined now by Catherine Collins. She's a former emergency room physician from Jackson and author of a book called How Healthy Is Your Doctor? The book makes the case that by eating healthier foods and getting more exercise, people can avoid a lot of common medical problems. Collins told Willow Belden that she decided to write the book because she wanted people to know how much power they have to impact their own health.
I noticed over my 30-year career that more people were coming into the ER at younger ages with more chronic diseases, and the lists of their medications were getting longer and longer. And the biggest reason for that happening is that there have never before been so many unhealthy nutrition and lifestyle choices for us to make. I wrote the book as a wake-up call for people and for doctors to start taking action to improve all of our health by making better choices.
Now, you make the assertion in the book that most doctors are focused on curing disease, not on making their patients healthy, which might seem like a very subtle distinction to a lot of people. What is the difference between being disease-free and being what you would actually call healthy?
The difference is that doctors are trained really well, and we're really expert at finding disease. And then we are trained and taught to use drugs and surgeries and procedures to manage these diseases. Health and wellness are really not a big part of our medical school or any of our training programs curricula. Health is more than just not having disease. Health is supporting yourself from the inside out with really healthy nutrients, active lives, a lot of sleep. You know, I mentioned the difference in my book between real prevention and what we all think of as prevention. And people think that, well, I'm going to get a mammogram and a colonoscopy and a diabetes test and all these tests so that I can be sure that I'm preventing disease. But they're not really preventing disease. They're just, all these tests just detect disease. So I'm really calling for people to get ahead of the curve on this and prevent disease from occurring so that when you do have your tests, they'll all be negative.
And one of the main points you make in the book is that the way to be healthy, to prevent disease, is pretty simple. It's through nutrition and exercise. I'm curious, though, are diet and exercise really the be-all and end-all of good health for everyone? Certainly, I personally know a few people who one would think had very healthy lifestyles and yet got cancer.
Sure. That brings up a good point, that what I'm talking about is certainly not absolute. Of course, there are many, many people who do as much as they can and learn as much as they can to promote their health and still develop some dreaded disease. What diet and nutrition will do for you, though, is it will protect you as best it can. In other words, the person who got cancer, if they had eaten terrible food and never gotten exercise and been overweight, my guess would be that they would have developed cancer either sooner, or it would have been worse, or they would have succumbed to it sooner. Or, I mean, there's only so much we can control. But what I'm saying is that the more that people can be more conscious in their daily lives about all the different elements of the health puzzle, I can guarantee you that their health outcomes and that their health in the present day will be better and will be more supportive of a vibrant and productive life.
Now, you make the case that it's better to fix health problems with things like nutrition and exercise changes rather than taking medicines. Why is that? I mean, what it would seem for a lot of people that it would be easier simply to take a prescription.
Sure, it's easier. The problem with that is that all medications have side effects. And I mentioned in the book that there's almost a Bible that we doctors have around us all the time called the Physician's Desk Reference, and it lists all the medications for which we can write prescriptions. And the lists of side effects and drug interactions and problems and potential risks are even longer than those ads on TV when they tell you, get your doctor to prescribe you this, but watch out for, you know, sudden death or all these other horrible things that can happen. Medicines are to be used as a last resort when you've done everything you could to improve your health parameters and you're still not getting there to where you and your doctor feel you need to be. Then is the time to start thinking about medication, but really not before.
Now, you used to be an ER doctor, and now you describe yourself as a lifestyle doctor. What does that mean, and how have you changed the way you practice medicine?
Lifestyle medicine, I believe, is the newest medical specialty. It's a growing group of physicians who, like me, have realized that the traditional medical paradigm of finding disease and treating it with medications and other options like surgeries and procedures, just isn't getting to the root of a lot of our patients' problems. One of the phrases that they use often is treat the cause. And by that, lifestyle medicine physicians mean let's step back, let's look at a person's whole lifestyle and their dietary practices and what sort of health challenges they're facing and see what we can help them change so that they can meet that health challenge.
So just to wrap up, for listeners who would like to have healthier lives, give us a few tips. What are the top three things that people should think about doing?
Number one, eat real food as much as possible. That's really huge. Processed food is everywhere, and it's really dragging down people's health. And hidden sugars are everywhere. People are consuming so much sugar, it's astonishing. So number one, if people want to start doing something to change their health, just pay attention. You know, that's the first step, is awareness. Just pay attention to how much processed food you're taking in on a day-to-day basis. The second thing that's super important is just try to be more active in your life. You don't have to join a gym. You don't have to make it a big burden. Just look at what you're doing every day and try to be more active. Park farther away from work, or I don't know, I'm happy that the place that I live in has several stairs, so I get to go up and down stairs every day, but moving your body is really key. And then the last one is sleep. And people love this tip, and I think it's really valid. Just paying attention to adding more quality sleep to your life will very much positively influence your health. I mean, if you're just going to do one thing, get more sleep.
And if we do all of these things, then we will live longer, be healthier, and be happier, right?
That's, yes, absolutely. You've got it.
All right. Well, Catherine Collins is author of How Healthy Is Your Doctor? What Your Doctor Doesn't Know About Health Could Be Hazardous to Yours. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear about the 5th Annual High Art Film Festival. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The 5th Annual High Art Film Festival is scheduled for next weekend at the historic High Art Theater in Lovell. The festival has culled 160 entries from around the world down to just about 50 films, comedies, drama, sci-fi, horror, and kids' movies. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer called the festival's creative guru, Jason Zeller, to find out what movies made the cuts.
If it makes me laugh, it normally makes the grade. If it makes me jump, it makes the grade.
And these are typically shorts. I mean, most of the films fall in this sort of 10 to 20 minute range. And I know there's an Oscar category for shorts, but it's something that outside of film festivals doesn't seem to get a lot of attention. What do you like about shorts?
It's like the weather in Wyoming. If you don't like it, wait 15 minutes and it'll change. It's the same thing with the film festival. If there's a film you don't like, just wait a few minutes and it'll change. And the shorts keep you on your toes. They keep the audience excited. You don't know what you're going to get next. And you could love it, you could hate it. And that's the beauty part about a film festival, is you don't have to like all the films.
Jason Zeller, is there a film that you are looking forward to seeing again with an audience, one that you already watched during the selection process?
Oh, there's many. I am really looking forward to this film festival, mainly because we normally get a lot of dramas. But this year we have a lot of comedies. We have 25 comedies and only 13 dramas. And I look at the comedies and they just make me laugh. And I want to see how other people react to them.
And that's the thing about movies that maybe we're losing a little bit in this era of everybody having their own device with their own media programming on it. There's something to be said for sitting in a theater and experiencing a film with other people.
Being a filmmaker myself, you don't know what is wrong or right with your film until you see it with a large audience. I worked on a film for 3.5 years, and I was able to show it at the first year of the High Art Film Festival, and it was really nice to see what the audience caught, what the audience laughed at, what the audience got scared of, what the audience didn't quite get that I needed to clarify a little better. And you don't get that from one person. You get that from a crowd reaction.
What would you tell somebody who's never been to a film festival before? Why should they come to a film festival?
There's so many different reasons. I know some people would say you come to a film festival to get culture. You come to a film festival to see other ideas. You come to a film festival to break out of your shell. And I personally would say you come to a film festival to see the movies before they're made into movies. And we have a couple films in the first years of the film festival that will be feature-length movies in the near future.
So these are the drafts?
Yeah. The best thing I like to describe it with is Napoleon Dynamite started out as a 10 or 15 minute short film, and it got picked up and they made a feature length film out of it, and it cost about $4,000 to make the short film. It cost about $400,000 to make the feature length, and the feature length made $40 million. And so there's great potential at a film festival for a film to become a big money maker.
So it can all start with a short film at a film festival.
It all could. And we have a couple films in the first years of the film festival that will be feature-length movies in the near future.
It's the 5th annual High Art Film Festival coming up on June 19th, 20th, and 21st at the historic High Art Theater in downtown Lovell. Jason Zeller is the creative guru for the festival. He's the one who sits through 6 months of movies to pick what should be shown to audiences. Jason, thanks so much for your time.
And thank you for having me. But then my chance to get to heaven slam. Oh, I used to worry about the future, but then I threw my caution to the wind. I had no reason to be carefree. No, until I took a trip.
It's time now for Wyoming Stories. 43 years ago, on June 15th, 1971, Jackson resident Bill Briggs made history. He was the first person ever to climb and descend the Grand Teton on skis, a feat most consider to be impossible. Briggs' friend Spark M. asked him to describe the experience.
Did you come up with this idea yourself to Grand? Or?
It was just pushed along. I'd like to tell the story of being in the Shady Lady Bar at Snow King, and we're sitting around the table, and I'm saying the Grand could be skied, and they said, no, it's impossible, couldn't be done, so I had to do it. So basically I was alone, which is okay. I've only got myself to take care of here.
So what happened? You're on the top of the mountain.
Oh, on top?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, the problems that you have. In those days, you didn't have plastic straps to hold on crampons. They were leather. You get to the top of the mountain, you have to take the crampons off. Now, getting the right one off, I have to do behind my back. Normally, you can just reach down, but I can't reach the foot to the fused hip. So I have to do this behind my back, and I find out the strap is frozen. Now, you have to warm up the hand and then unfreeze the strap and go back and forth that way half a dozen times. Finally, get the strap off. Now, you get the crampons off and you're on a crusted surface. And you can put on the downhill ski. Now, when you go to put on the uphill ski and you lean over and there is no flat ground, all you have is this rounded egg shape at the top of the mountain. You go down to put the other ski on, and the one that you're standing on starts to go forward around the egg. To get the second ski on was a real challenge. I mean, that's really difficult. Then skiing down, that's easy. Very tight in between the rocks off the summit. It's very narrow going on a hard crust and just wonderful, fun skiing. I know I'm going to break through the crust at some point, who knows when. And when the skis do break through, I fall over downhill and you roll over and get right back up again. It's a nonstop action, which I'm used to doing. No problem. Zip right back up and ski down Petzold Ridge, and it's narrowing. It's got a cornice on one side, rocks on the other. The snow is perfect. Skis are perfect. I mean, the whole thing is just, you know, how could it be any better? And then you go out on the east face. The east face, I know, is going to slide. The thing is to pick the exact place where the slide will break off. I had spotted just where I wanted to go on the way up. So it was a matter of cutting across and making sure it would slide. So I cut across, and boy, it slid just perfect. And you just back up a little and ski down where it had slid off. When I go down, I do the final bit through that narrow, steep, narrower than my skis were long. That was a really tricky thing to pull off. That's the big challenge. Skiing through there, I don't know many, if anybody, has since done it. They all rappel that. I didn't have a rope. I couldn't rappel it. I had to ski it. So
what happened when you were walking down the end of this?
Oh, on the trail down. Yeah, you get down on the trail. You came across a couple who were coming up. And yeah, they asked, where have you, you know, you've been skiing, yeah. So where did you ski up on the Grand Teton? For how high up from the top? How many times? Just once. Oh, that's too bad.
So, Bill, when you got back to the bar, the Shady Lady or wherever, then what?
No one would believe it.
That is Bill Briggs, the father of extreme skiing, telling his friend Spark M about the first ever descent from Grand Teton by ski. You can hear more Wyoming stories on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thank you for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear it again or listen to individual segments, you can go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that same website. Anna Rader is our web editor. All of our reporters can be found on Twitter, and we also invite you to become a fan of our Facebook page called Wyoming Public Radio News. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.